นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังคุณุตรังอุปัชฌายังนามาสามิSo I'd like to recap some of the points we've been talking about the last couple of days and to expand upon one or two to give a little bit more context. So I made a distinction between belief system religions and education system religions, suggesting that these are two kind of families of religions. The belief system religions tend to be much more popular, and they are defined and characterized by the set of beliefs or dogmas which followers of the religion are required to sign up for. The importance, the central importance of faith in those religions can be seen most simply by the fact that the word faith is often used instead of the word religion. So it's as common to refer to the Christian faith these days as it is to the Christian religion, or as the Islamic faith. And often religions are referred to as the faiths, the great faiths of the world. So in Buddhism, if it's as I suggest, it is an education system, does that mean that there's no role for faith? Or what is the role of faith? So in this education system, faith is considered to be a tool that we make use of in our education of ourselves as human beings. So this is not an education of one particular area of life or one particular skill, but it's an education of our humanity. And so we look at faith as a mental factor, or sometimes it's called a faculty, sometimes it's called a power. So what are the essential elements of faith? And faith simplifies. One of the traditional similes to explain what faith is or can be is of an apparently legendary kind of jewel. And if you were walking in the countryside, in India, 2,000 years ago, and you wanted to some clear water to drink, then maybe you would come to puddles which carts and bullocks have walked through, and the water is muddy. So this jewel has had this ability. You put the jewel in the water, and the water clears, and then you can drink the water. So this is a simile for faith. Now, it might not seem such an obvious simile, but the idea is that there are so many things that we can take an interest in life, so many things to study, so many things demanding our attention. And so how do we make a decision? The rational mind is not necessarily the best tool. So when I grew up, there was a very popular TV program called Star Trek, and the second in command of Star Trek, he's half Vulcan, and so he's like contrasted with a very emotional captain, and he does everything in a super rational way. So this is kind of the ideal of the rational mind. You know, he's not affected or afflicted by emotion. But there are people who are like Spock in the world, and these are people who have had serious car accidents, for instance, and a certain part of their brain has been destroyed, and so they are completely emotionless beings, and they do everything according to logic. And it's very interesting to see how they cope in the world. None of them have reached a high rank in the Starfleet, as far as I know. But what happens is that these people become almost completely dysfunctional. For instance, such a person goes to the supermarket and they have to buy like a brand of shampoo or toothpaste or something, and there's like 7, 8, 10 different brands to choose from, and they start to try to think logically, which one should I take? And of course, you know, there's the differences between them are minor or are completely unimportant. So it means that there's no sense of proportion and prioritization. And there's this analytical approach to everything. The problem is it's so time-consuming, and you can spend a lot of time making intellectual decisions about very minor matters and have no time left for anything more important. And this gives a clue to the value of emotion in life, and this particular emotion of faith. Faith is you don't have all the information that you need to make many decisions in life. There's so many times where you just have to gather all the information that you can and then take a jump. There are always risks, there are no guarantees. So the logical mind always wants everything absolutely guaranteed. And of course, that's not really possible in life, or very rarely possible. So faith is that which clears the waters and just says, yeah, this, I'm going for this, and I make a commitment to this. And so what happens when someone has a faith in something or somebody or something, it's a gathering of energies. So rather than your energy going off here and going off there and thinking and debating and analyzing, it's all brought in. And so the people with faith are very powerful. You know, you see these people with very strong faith, and they've got these bright eyes, and they're just very charismatic. So people who, you know, like leaders of these faith-based religions and cults are often very powerful figures, because they have this incredible, you know, these like bright eyes, and they're like incredible charismatic, because they've focused all their energy. So this is the sattva or faith simplifies. It chooses where we're going to put our energy. It gathers our energy, so it gives rise to energy. Now the now in Buddhism we're saying, well, that's the pro, that's the advantage of it. But what about the disadvantages? What are the drawbacks? What are the things that we have to be careful about? Well, if we're not very vigilant and careful, then faith can become fanaticism, or it can become superstition. So this is the shadow of faith that we see throughout world religions, isn't it, and the belief systems. Wherever there's strong faith, there's superstition, there is fanaticism, there's this strong sense of us and them, and all the problems that arise because of that. So the key feature of the Buddhist Dhamma, the Buddha Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, and it's a very important thing to remember, is that the Buddha did not teach like individual virtues. Say you should have this and this and this. The Buddha had this incredibly profound understanding which enabled him to see not only what are like good qualities to have in your life, but the relationship between them and the way they dovetail, and what should balance what, and what should come first, what should come afterwards. So it's a system. It's not just saying you should be a good person and you should have this quality and you should have that quality. He's saying, how does this particular quality come into being? What prevents it from coming into being? What do you have to cultivate first before that quality can mature? So wherever, if you look in the sutta, you'll notice straight away that whenever the Buddha spoke about faith, he always also spoke about wisdom. And wisdom here meaning the critical faculty. So in the faith-based systems, reason and intelligence, intellect, the critical faculty is distrusted, because it can so easily undermine faith. And so thinking about the objects of faith is often considered to be arrogant, and the work of the devil even. In Buddhism, we have a teaching we call ahipassiko. It invites investigation. It encourages investigation. It's telling you, put these teachings to the test. And the critical faculty is that which prevents faith from becoming superstition or fanaticism. So it's a safeguard. Now, the Buddhist teachings are then most often, most commonly, it's a very obvious feature, are presented in groups. So we've been talking about some of these groups already, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. It's full of numbers, isn't it, the Theravada teaching. And this is a cause of some discomfort for monks like myself who give a lot of talks in Thailand, because there are quite a lot of people who go to listen to Dhamma talks in order to get numbers for the lottery. And sometimes people come up to you and say, thank you so much, you know, yeah, you never let me down. And the way this works is, if you've got so just to give you a bit of information, like there's the national lottery and then there's the underground lottery, and the underground lottery people play the last three numbers of the national lottery. So people want three numbers. So if you have 200 people listening out for numbers, and they're like Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, and then get on to higher dimensions like emptiness, that's a 0, 4, 8, 0. And then somebody else is listing like 3 characteristics, body and mind is 2, there's 4 monks sitting listening. So you can imagine if everybody's like working out a number, you get 200 people, you know, it's quite likely that one of them will get it right. And then that person tells everybody, oh, Ajahn Chah, sorry, gives such great numbers, you see. So I have to be very careful with numbers when you give talks. After Ajahn Chah's funeral, I walked from Ubon to Bangkok along the railway line, and saw people say, where are you from? Who's your teacher? So, and say Ajahn Chah, oh, Ajahn Chah, he's got fantastic teachers. I say, oh, you know, quite pleased, you know, like every part of Thailand. You say, yeah, you say, and the reason was because, like his funeral was on 16th of January, and the number came up, 161, you see. And everybody knew it was going to come up, because that was like the great compassion of an arahant. You know, it's his last gift to the world, is to give all the poor people the lottery number. And it came up. And, you know, all the lottery sellers from, you know, they all ran away because they couldn't pay up all in Ubon. But people all over the country, you know, got this great surge of faith in Lumpo Shah because the lottery number came up. So this is a little bit of background to like Thai Buddhism. things that you won't come across in the books. You know, the teachings are presented in groups. And the reason is that there is this organic connection between the virtues that the Buddha discovered and revealed. So sometimes people are like this kind of interfaith, or some people come up with this idea of having like sort of a super religion where you take the best bits of this one and that one, and you mix them all together, and oh yeah, they talk about this virtue in all the religions, so that must be one of the main ones, and this kind of pick and mix idea. But the fact that there is other religions or systems refer to some elements doesn't mean that they know how those things fit together. So you can have all the components of a computer laid out in front of you, but unless you know how those are put together, you don't have a computer. And so this is a part of our faith as Buddhists, that the Buddha's not only teaching virtues, but he knew how they fitted together and how they support each other. So in one of the main groups, we call the 5 faculties, the 5 powers, there's the first of those is faith, and the second is effort. And the third is mindfulness, and the fourth is samadhi, and the fifth is wisdom. And this particular group is very, very beautiful one, in a way, because there are 2 ways of looking at this group. One is a step-by-step progression, meaning that with faith as your base, effort arises. And when you have the correctly established faith and you have right effort, then mindfulness will prosper or will flourish. And when you have a mindfulness which is based upon faith and effort, then samadhi will arise. And when your samadhi is one which is the result of a mindfulness which has been produced through faith and effort, then you have the grounds for wisdom. So it's a step-by-step progression. But there is a second way of looking at this same group. And here you can imagine like a seesaw, and like the middle was called the fulcrum. So on one end there is faith, and on the other end is wisdom, and they balance. And then inside you have effort and concentration or samadhi, and they balance. And the third middle factor, mindfulness, is the fulcrum. So it's mindfulness that establishes the balance between faith and wisdom, and between effort and concentration. So if you have, as I say, a lot of faith, but you don't have wisdom, then you can easily get caught in the trap of fanaticism or superstition. If you have a lot of wisdom, a very intellectual, analytical kind of mind, but you lack faith, the Buddha compared it to someone who gets sick because of medicine. The medicine itself makes you sick. And there's too much thinking and too much analysis, and it's too scattered and it's not focused because it lacks that emotional commitment. If there's a lot of effort, but there's no inner stillness or stability, then that results in agitation. If there's too much stillness, but there's no effort, then there's stagnation. So this is how you can see the beauty of it, and you know the genius of the Buddha to be able to recognize this and to explain it and to show how these factors act upon each other. So another group are the four Brahma Viharas, and these are the heavenly dwellings, and these are the exalted emotions. So we talked about faith as an emotional term, but again, there is this idea of Theravada Buddhism, or sort of sometimes referred to a derogatory as Hinayana, has been kind of dry and passionless kind of teaching. And it's really far from that. So although there is the encouragement to let go of the passion for the sensual world, or at least to govern it so that it doesn't become like an obsession in the case of a householder, this is not a kind of a blanket condemnation of emotion. This morning I spoke about desire in a similar fashion, that the Buddha is not condemning all desire, but he's encouraging us to use that energy of desire, the will towards, and to shift it or to channel it away from the craving channel into the chanda channel, from the wish to from the desire to get and to have and to become and to get rid of, into the desire to do good, to realize the truth, to create things that are of benefit and happiness for ourselves and others. Similarly, the emotional energy, it's an energy in itself. So we don't want to just completely abandon that or deny that, but we want to channel that emotional energy into the Brahma Viharas. And so the Brahma Vihara, there are four Brahma Viharas: Metta, loving kindness; Karuna, compassion; Mudita is sympathetic joy; and Upekha, equanimity. Now in that group, I think you'll see that the fourth is kind of the odd man out. Because I think, generally speaking, we don't usually think of equanimity as an emotion. We tend to confuse it with indifference. So what's the difference between indifference and equanimity? Well, indifference just means when you can maintain, it's like a steady mind by just closing your eyes to suffering, turning your back on it, denying it, or saying it's their problem, it's not our problem, or just hardening your heart to suffering and becoming dull and just making like an armor plate around your heart, you know, so you don't have to feel anything. So that's certainly not what the Buddha is teaching. But the equanimity arises through wisdom and wise reflection, particularly on the law of karma. And this is expressed very beautifully in the Buddha statues and Buddhist art, in which the Buddha is this still, calm, equanimous figure, and yet his eyes are open. Now, there are some Buddha statues and meditation where the Buddha's eyes are closed, but in almost all Buddhist iconography, the eyes are open, which means the Buddha is still and calm and at peace, even though he sees the suffering of sentient beings. And this is the equanimity. So these four qualities are also have an organic connection, which is why they're grouped together. So the metta, and the word metta is derived from the word mitta. So mitta means friend, and so metta is essentially friendliness, but usually to bring out the particular quality of metta. In English, it's usually the loving friendship, loving kindness, just to bring out the particular warmth and kindness involved. But friendship is one of the key themes in Theravada Buddhism. And again, this rather goes against the image of Theravada Buddhism as like the solitary striver and the self-reliant spiritual hero. So there is that side of Theravada teaching, certainly. But at the same time, the Buddha laid great emphasis on good friendship, right from in the very basic level of choosing your friends well. And this is particularly important in society, in Asian societies, in which the group is often stronger and more important than the individual. So if you get into the wrong group, it has a more catastrophic effect than maybe on for Western culture. I mean, this is obviously a generalization. But on a higher level, the teacher in Theravada is not a guru. He's not a god. There are many similarities, in fact, between Vajrayana teachings and the teachings of the Thai forest tradition, which are not so obvious because of the external differences. But underlying it, there are many common attitudes. But the one significant difference is the attitude towards the teacher. And in Theravada Buddhism, the ideal of the teacher is the good friend, the ultimately good friend, rather than someone that you worship or you put onto a pedestal. And one of the one of the things that really attracted me to this school of Buddhism and to become a monk in this school of Buddhism was the Vinaya discipline, which makes all monks subject to the rules that we take on when we become monks. And there are absolutely no exceptions to these rules, which is to say that an 80-year-old arahant has to keep every single rule that he kept when he was a 20-year-old novice, or the first day of his monkhood. So there is no idea or concept that when you reach a certain level of spiritual maturity, you no longer have to keep all the same rules. You're beyond the rules. You cannot be judged by the same standards as an ordinary person. So, in the Theravada view, there's no argument that certain beings can be beyond the need for conventional morality or moral standards. But in our view of compassion, then monks, enlightened monks, keep all the rules out of compassion, not because they need to, as a personal practice anymore, to go against their bad habits or to prevent them acting in unskillful ways, but to be a good example. And the famous example of this is Mahakasapa, who was the great ascetic disciple of the Buddha. And in his old age, the Buddha himself suggested he might relax some of his practices. You know, you're an old man now, you don't need to do all this. Mahakasapa asked permission to carry on. He said, "I'm not doing it for myself, I'm doing it for future generations." So this is the specific kind of Theravada idea of compassion, where you maintain a standard of conduct, not just for yourself, but for future generations. You see, if you have I mentioned before, like a persistent problem in not only in monastic circles, but throughout groups of meditators, is overestimation of attainment. So if you have an idea, when you've reached a certain state of attainment, you don't have to keep all the rules anymore, and you also have the possibility that you can overestimate your attainment, then you can have people acting in very unskillful ways, thinking and teaching others that you're no longer creating kamma, you've gone beyond that. And so there have been so many scandals in Buddhist groups throughout the world, when this idea of the teacher as being beyond all conventional morality is abused, and it is abused a lot. And so this system says, even if you are beyond this, you keep the rule to be a good example. So if you're a student, and you see the teacher, now the teacher can do this and can do that because he's enlightened, and you think, well, maybe I could. I don't feel that so much kind of, if I could do that, it wouldn't really affect my meditation very much. Maybe, you see, that's the kind of thinking you have. But then you have a teacher like Ajahn Chah, and then maybe some of the rules you think, this is so kind of petty and unnecessary, and I can't really see the point of it, using your logical mind. And I could stop doing that, it wouldn't really affect my meditation very much. But then you think, well, if a great monk like Ajahn Chah still did it, then what excuse have I got for giving up and not doing it? You see, so it has a very good effect on the student. The idea that you do this as an offering to the Buddha. So I often, like the monks in this tradition, you know, we're often praised for being very strict. And I always find this kind of like strange in a way. And I've often said to people, you know, like if you had a child, a small child, you know, and he's obedient to his parents, do you praise that child? Well, he's a really strict son, you know. He does what his parents tell him. He's so strict. You see, we just, of course he does, you know, he's a child and he's obedient to his parents' wishes out of respect and love and gratitude towards them. And this is the attitude of a Buddhist monk. It's not like I'm a strict monk, but like the Buddha is our father and the Buddha laid down these rules and we all become monks voluntarily. Nobody makes us become monks. And when we become monks, it's like then part of that is we promise to respect and love and to follow the Buddha's teachings. And the Buddha says, if you're a monk, then you have to do this. If you don't want to do this, then be a lay Buddhist. If you want to be a monk, you should do this and you should give that up. And for the whole of your life. And so it's not... You sort of take, you know, being a super strict ascetic, and it's just out of respect and gratitude and love for the Buddha that you do this. And I was pointing out to somebody today that in terms of looking at Buddhist societies and Thai society in particular, that it's very interesting to me that this principle of no exceptions, as you get more senior, more well-known, more wise, more enlightened, but on the moral side, you maintain the same standards that you always did. And yet, in Thailand, you know, one of the huge problems we have is this. To my eye, at least to my view, is this whole idea of apisit. And apisit means that when you get a little bit more senior, you don't have to do the same things everybody else does. You have all these exceptions and you get someone else to do it. And this kind of exceptionalism and special privilege, which is deeply embedded in the society, is in fact not an outgrowth or an expression of Buddhist culture, but it's a betrayal of it if you look at the original principles laid down by the Buddha. So with a education system, this is the job of the monks to point out the ways in which the pure teachings have become distorted and corrupted over the course of time. And often, you know, when monks are not doing this job and not transmitting and educating people correctly, then Buddhism goes into decline. So returning to this idea of metta and karuna, metta as being is a sense of friendliness. So sometimes if we emphasize the loving side, it establishes too high a standard. You know, people start to think, oh, you should love everybody. So it's like universal love, you know. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a sort of hippie period, so I quite like this myself, you know. You know, you can't do it, can you? I mean, how can you can't love everybody? What does it even mean, anyway? It's kind of a nice slogan, but what you can do is wish everybody well. You can wish people well. Now, I think that's a very practical standard. So often people will say, "Oh, I feel I should have metta," but there's this, and I can do it, metta for all sentient beings. You feel really good, and then you wake up and say, "Except for him," it's like there's always someone that's, the spanner in the works, and. So it's not that you should have this kind of special, beautiful emotion for everybody all the time. That's just, as I say, impractical and too high a standard. But in the case of somebody who's behaving very badly, someone who's immoral and cruel and nasty person, spread metta for a person like that? So what people think is, how can I feel love for a totally unlovable person? It's not possible. I can't do it. But the answer is that it's like judo, if you like. What is it about that person that's just so obnoxious? Okay, so he's totally selfish person. Never thinks about anybody else but his own desires and his own enjoyments. So then you take that and you say to yourself, may that person experience the happiness of unselfishness. May they find a way to free themselves from the bond of selfish desire. Or if that person's very cruel, may that person in their life discover the happiness of kindness and be free of cruelty. So rather than saying, because this person is like this, I can't feel anything positive towards them, rather than being an obstacle, that becomes the point at which you focus the metta. So it's good to also accumulate stories and observations of metta as a way of. I have some lovely metta, so I tell you one which I like a lot. And it's a true story, I believe. In the 17th century in Europe, there was a war. In fact, it was a number of different wars which all kind of melted into one, but it is called the 30 Years' War, and many different countries in Europe were drawn into this at various times. So in one of the battles, which if I remember rightly was between Sweden and Denmark, it doesn't really matter, but so one of the soldiers who survived the battle was walking through the battlefield. And so there are kind of groans and pain. And of course, you probably know when people have been wounded on the battlefield, they suffer incredibly from thirst. So the man was walking along, the soldier was walking along, and he hears this groan, water, water. And he walks over to give the man a drink of water. And then the soldier on the ground, who is groaning, is of the other side. He's the enemy. And this man looks up, and he sees that the person walking towards him is the enemy. And then he lifts up his sword, and he's about to kill the man who's come to help him, out of a very pure intention of metta. Fortunately, the kind person is, he draws back and he say, he doesn't die. And then he said, I was going to give you this flask of water, and you tried to kill me. that's how you repay me for my kindness. So I'm going to punish you. So he takes the water flask and he drinks it. And he said, so I was going to give you this whole flask. And now I'm going to punish you. I'm only going to give you half and I'm going to drink some myself. This is like metta, you know. So, you can imagine what would be the alternative. You ungrateful person, you know, doing this out of the goodness of my heart. You almost kill me, you know. You just die, you know. It's like something like that, you know. It serves you right. And what he did was he's in fact very thirsty himself, but he was going to give all his water away. So his punishment is he's just going to have a little bit before he gives it away. But these kinds of, I love these kinds of examples and how, you know, there is that, you know, it's a strong and a commitment to kindness. It's not one that's easily dissuaded or put off by disappointment or trying to act kindly and to help others be happy and then being offended when people don't appreciate what you're doing, or misinterpret it, or accuse you perhaps of having some ulterior motives. And this is part of the practice, you know, that these kinds of things happen. You know, it's not like because you have a pure intention, everybody's going to respond to that in a positive way and think you're wonderful. Often people will look at it and out with a sense of suspicion or lack of trust. Is what's this person trying to get out of this? So it is a practice on many different levels. So generally, this is the of these four. This is, we can say, this is kind of the default. And the second is in particular cases where someone is suffering or there is suffering, then we seek to alleviate it wherever we can. And Venerable Kovilo's readings and explanations of Four Noble Truths emphasize how important we turn our mind to and we're brave enough to look right at suffering. But when we say suffering is a noble truth, then does that mean, you know, that people all over the world say, yeah, I'm suffering? Does that mean that I understand Buddha's Four Noble Truths? But it's understanding suffering. But if you have the sense of I am suffering, that's not a noble truth. There is suffering is the noble truth. But when it becomes poor little me, I'm suffering, I'm so miserable, my life is so bad. That's not insight into the noble truth of suffering. And that's not compassion, it is self-pity. So avoiding that sense of me. And so when you're looking in meditation at the body and the mind, and you're seeing, beginning to understand what impermanence means and what dukkha means and what lack of self means, then over the course of time, what you notice is it's not suffering that arises in your own body and mind, which is a problem or is something which needs to be addressed, but it's suffering anywhere. And the distinction between self and others, this suffering and other people's suffering, starts to dissolve. And sometimes suffering outside of your own life becomes even more unbearable than your own suffering. Is, you know, as you practice, there's suffering there, but you have some confidence that you can deal with this. You know, but then you see other people who have no resources, have never trained their mind, have no inner strength to deal with things, And it's more distressing. So the movement to try to alleviate suffering is one which is no longer affected by this very strong sense of distinction between self and others. And you know, there are a lot of there's an interesting question, you know, about what's really going on in my mind, and am I kidding myself, or am I? And I talked about overestimation, and sometimes, you know, there are these people have these Western people have these arguments like you're like this. They say, no, I'm not. Yes, you are. Look, I'd know if I was like that. No, you wouldn't. You're repressing it. It's unconscious. You know, they said, so, you know, what do you do when somebody tells you that? You know, so, and how can you respond and how can you be sure? So one of the things to observe is what happens when something happens out of the blue and completely unexpected. How do you respond to that? And that's a very good indication of where your mind's at. And when suddenly somebody's very unkind to you, or suddenly somebody's very kind to you, and how the heart responds to unplanned, unexpected events. This is a very good indicator of the maturity of our practice. And for all the different ideas about, you know, the human heart and whether or not, you know, we are essentially selfish beings, like the selfish gene, or whether there is something as altruism, I think that we can observe enough to have a confidence in altruism. I have last in December, I went on a long walk through the countryside in India. So I wanted to walk from Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha was enlightened, to Kusinara, where he passed away, as a celebration of my 60th birthday. And I did a lot of research using Google Maps, so I was able to find a route. No, I mean, Google Maps is the best thing that's happened to the Tudong tradition for many, many years. No, I mean, these days, you know, Tudong's no fun at all. You're walking along busy roads, traffic, heat, no shade. You know, not many monks want to do that. But with Google Maps, you can find small paths, minor roads, avoid traffic. And this is what I did in India. And I was walking through along cart tracks or between rice fields and far away from busy roads and pollution. And it was a most wonderful walk. The total distance was about 300 and something kilometers. So it was quite a long way, and I was walking, you know, as far as in many ways, not exactly, but in many ways, like a monk in the time of the Buddha, and walking alone. And so a monk has no money, and I didn't speak the language, so. It was this sense of just being just an ordinary monk walking through the Indian countryside. And there were so many experiences of kindness and generosity. And one I've spoken about a lot since I got back, because it affected me very much, was the last few days, this whole of northern India was blanketed in very thick fog. And it was like walking through a tunnel, the fog was so thick that, you know, I wouldn't be able to see that window there. And it's quite uncomfortable. and cold. And I was walking, it was about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning, something like this. And I was walking along this small lane, and two old ladies just appeared out of the fog. And I must have appeared, for them, I must have, you know, and I think it quite, you know, a road that they walk every day, and suddenly, you know, what's that? Who's that? You know, it's like a, you know, it must have been totally unexpected. And the woman, one of the old ladies, looked at me, and she pointed to her head, and she made some gesture. Of course, I didn't understand her words, but I understand what she meant. And I had a hat, and I lost my hat. And so I was walking bareheaded in this very cold weather and fog. And the moment she saw me, the thing was, put something on your head, you're going to catch a cold. You know, it's this beautiful, like, old grandmother, you know, thought. And but what was so impressive to me is that, you know, it was completely unplanned. As I say, I just loomed up out of the fog, you know, completely unexpected, strange figure, probably quite intimidating figure. And her immediate thought was, look, he hasn't got anything on his head. It's so cold. He's gonna get the flu or something. And she sort of put something on your head. So I find that this, and I'm sure you've all had experiences like this. This is not something, you know, sort of out of the ordinary, but maybe something that we don't really think about very much. But for me, that there is in the human heart, there is this capacity for an immediate, unplanned, altruistic impulse, you know, a care for others, a concern. There's somebody that you've never met before and you'll never ever meet again. You don't know who he is or where he's come from, but you don't want him to catch a cold. And that's one of the, you know, this is the beauty of human beings, that we have this within us, this jewel in the mind. And we have all those other things, and we have fears and anxieties and selfishness and greed. Sure, we're not saying those things don't exist. But there is this seed of goodness and purity and kindness that we can cultivate and educate, and that's the heart of Buddhism. How do we take that seed of goodness and nourish it and develop it? Because we all have it within us. So recognizing that goodness and trying to support it, and this third Brahma Vihara of Mudita is opening your eyes to the goodness and the kindness and of people around you. And just in the small details of life, there are so many small acts of kindness and goodness taking place, and if we open our eyes to them and recognize them, we feel nourished by it. You know, we feel it's like just a steady stream, cool stream in the heart. You know, there is, for all the things that we read in the newspapers and we hear and see, and it just seems like the world is such a depressing mess. You know, that at the same time, those things are true, and there are some very frightening and worrying things in the world, but there is at the same time something very beautiful and many, many things around us, and recognizing them, allowing them to nourish our heart, and expressing appreciation. This is what we call anumodana. And this anumodana, not only of other people and things going on around us, but anumodana of the goodness in your own heart. Often, good people are so afraid of being sort of proud and puffed up and conceited, and which is, you know, a wise attitude. But also, if it's taken too far, it means we dismiss the goodness within us. So I want to draw an analogy here because I find very useful. You know, if you, let's say you have a garden at the back of your house and you grow some flowers, and you put some hard work into this, you water them, you take care of the flowers, and then they bloom and it's so beautiful. And somebody comes and visits you, and you take them to see the garden, and they say, "Oh, such beautiful flowers." So how do you feel? You know, you don't feel kind of puffed up and proud, you know, you don't feel conceited, because it's not you, it's something that you've grown, and that has its own reality, and it's not just you that is responsible for that. It's the soil and the air and the atmosphere and so many other things. But at the same time, you feel proud in a good way because, yeah, those flowers are there because of you and because of the work you put into cultivating them. And this is how we should reflect on our own virtues. And, you know, our honesty, our kindness, our integrity, our patience and whatever it is, these are like flowers that we've grown. And we can take joy and pleasure in them, just as we can take joy and pleasure in the flowers in our garden without worrying that we're becoming conceited and think we're special. Because the goodness that arises, it's not our property. It's not who we are. It's things that we have developed according to the universal law of causes and conditions. So this is something to, when we start to meditate in particular, it's a sobering experience because we come face to face with all kinds of things we probably don't want to, and most people would prefer not to look at. We begin to see just the kind of pettiness and the greeds and the desires and the fears and the anxieties and all this kind of stuff we'd probably rather shut the door on. But, you know, we're taking this on and we're looking at these things. But we have to balance this also with an acknowledgement of the goodness and the good qualities in our lives and the good things that we've done. So I'm talking, so this is a rather long talk this evening, but just to a few more words on the fourth quality of equanimity. So you want to, as far as possible, support people to be happy. You wish them well. If they're suffering, you want to help in whatever way you can to alleviate the suffering. When you see people who are happy and achieving success, whether it's in their careers or in their family life or in their spiritual life, then developing the ability to rejoice in that and to let go of jealousy and competition. But sometimes we want to make people happy, we want to help others, but we can't do it. We're not in a position to do it. The person we want to help doesn't want to be helped. They're quite happy to be in at this time in that particular state. They don't trust us. They don't want us to be involved. We lack the necessary skills. So many reasons in which we find very difficult to help others. So how do we feel about that? Where do we place our mind when that's, and because if we allow our mind to suffer, then we've lost the path altogether. So the Buddha's recommend we dwell in equanimity, and this equanimity arises from reflecting on the law of karma. So in the chant that we are the owner of our karma, we are the heirs of our karma, we're born of our karma by support. So we all have a karmic work to do. We have a karmic debt, a karmic inheritance. And there's only so much that one person can do for another person. We do what we can, But there are limits to what we can do, because everyone has karma that they have accumulated, not just in this life, but in many, many previous lives. So we dwell in equanimity, but there's a readiness. It's not like saying, okay, I can't do anything, just, you know, I leave it to you now. It's not writing somebody off, but it's saying that this, the time is not yet ripe to be able to do anything useful. So this is the time to look after my own heart, and to be ready, whenever is possible, to do what needs to be done or to do what can be done. So there is still this very strong wish to help and to be of use, but there's a recognition that this is not the time and place. It's not possible right now. So this is why these four qualities are a group. So you know, when is the appropriate time for the metta, the appropriate time for compassion, time for rejoicing in goodness of others and of ourselves, and the time to dwell in that calm evenness of mind. So talking about the organic, holistic nature of this education system and the various components of it, tonight I've talked about two in particular, this group of five faculties or powers: faith, effort, mindfulness, samadhi and wisdom, and the four brahmaviharas of metta, karuna, mudita and upekkha. And so I'd like to end the evening talk at this point.